Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the SBAI podcast series. The SBAI has been around since our alternative investment standards were created for asset managers back in 2008. Since then, we've evolved into an active alliance of over 150 asset managers and over 90 institutional investors dedicated to advancing responsible practices, partnership, and knowledge. Our podcast series brings you insight and commentary from leading figures in the industry on a variety of topical issues. Today's podcast is a conversation on China. China continues to be of interest to asset managers and allocators, but exposure to this market can often be limited to both real and perceived risks. At the SBAI, we run a dedicated China working group of over 35 representatives from both asset managers and allocators. Our previous publications on China, including Guidance for Chinese Onshore Managers Moving Offshore and Comparison of Chinese Regulation to International Standards, can be found in our China Toolbox on our website, sbai.org.
My name is Alvin Fan. I'm the CEO and director of OP Investment Management. We are a hedge fund platform based out of Hong Kong. I've been around and been a part of one of the oldest partnerships in Hong Kong, the Oriental Patron Financial Group. And our mission is to help emerging managers build track record in Asia and help them bridge that gap to becoming institutional investment managers for institutional capital. We currently run about 40 managers across $2 billion in assets, and we're always looking for the next great investment manager. Today we have with me Dr. Mark Smith. Mark, it's good to have you.
Well, thanks very much, Alvin. So I appreciate the intro. So Northwest is a firm that was established in 1998. So we've been going for quite a long time. Originally, when we started investing, we were global. So with the US, Europe, and Asia. And then about 2001, we just saw the opportunities disappear in the US and Europe, and they grew in Asia. So therefore, we devoted our whole group to Asia and specifically to China. And that's a result of the fact that the markets are deep, they're liquid, they're inefficient, and hedge funds are not the dominant players in this market, which all of these things is really important. You imagine the US, which we were before, there's $1 trillion of hedge fund money, really smart guys, massive infrastructure, and it's difficult for a group like ourselves to compete. I mean, we manage about $2 billion. There, we were kind of small fry. In Asia, actually, and specifically in China, there, because of these barriers to entry, because of the lack of hedge funds, and because of the large size of the markets. I mean, China is the second largest economy in the world, the second largest equity market in the world, one of the largest bond markets in the world, and Western investors have almost zero exposure to it. They are woefully underallocated to China. And that creates opportunities. In addition, actually, the markets have a nascent level of capital markets. So they're growing, they're expanding, but it's taking time. They're moving very, very slowly. I think they learned from some of the mistakes that Japan made in the mid-80s after the Plaza Accord, when the US and UK and France and other people encouraged them to effectively increase the value of their currency. And literally, they lost a lot of advantages and they fully opened up the capital markets. And they spent the next 25 years in trouble. China's kind of learned from that and is literally going forward at its own pace.
So Mark, when we talk about barriers to entry, you know, I from a business perspective, I always look at it from the other side as well. That barrier to entry for global investors to come into the market also gives us a business, right? Just simply same thing for us. It gives us a modus operandum, a reason to be, to help bridge that gap from onshore or offshore allocators looking to traverse both the country risk and just the evolutionary dynamic that's made China so interesting. But even after 20 years of being in the capital markets, it still looks like it's not yet entirely tapped in with the rest of the world. The last time we had a discussion, you and I were talking about how, you know, a lot of us in the industry have helped the regulators wrap their head around changing their capital markets. And it would be great for you to maybe share a bit about your experience in helping the Chinese regulators sort of step up to the plate and join the new world.
Yeah, that's a very, very expansive question, actually. There's a lot to cover there. I mean, when we first started investing in 2003, when foreigners were first allowed into the equity markets, there were loads of uncertainties. You know, in terms of risks, we didn't know about repatriation, we didn't know about tax, we didn't know about voting rights. So literally, we treaded very carefully, small size, we really got to understand the market, and we met with the regulator, and we've had pretty much yearly meetings with them. And 2008 happened, and the regulator, it had taken steps, it introduced an equivalent to CDS, credit risk mitigation contracts, and it stopped those. It introduced warrants and options and derivatives, and literally it just closed a lot of that down in 2008, and it blamed some of those things on the collapse of the market, which of course it wasn't. But the regulator has continued to move forward. You know, you look at what's happened. I think we're almost at a point of inflection for the market. A few years ago, we had Stock Connect, where you can buy stocks through Hong Kong. Hong Kong is a transition city. It's a gateway to China, and that's why both of us are based here. And it still continues to be, and actually, arguably more so, since a lot of the US listings are coming back onshore to Hong Kong. But you've had Stock Connect, you've had Bond Connect, you've had an increase in Q fee, you've had so many, you know, you've had clarification of capital gains tax, you've had clarification of voting rights, which is positive. They really want to increase investment in China. They really want Chinese companies to tap the international capital markets. I've had a lot of questions about risks. Investors have been asking about Evergrande and Kaiser, so real estate, Chinese real estate companies, and how's that affecting you? And in reality, actually, in the Chinese market, very few of these were actually listed domestically in China, simply because actually they didn't meet the standards to be able to list. They were too leveraged or you know, didn't meet the profitability requirements. This massive rise of debt and concerns about housing has slowed down the effectively 30% of local government revenue comes from land sales. So the central government has lots of money. Individual people have money, but the kind of middle gap, the local government, is kind of, that's the one that we're most concerned with. And what they do have, that, and literally their revenue will go down by 30% or probably less, but what they have got is they've got thousands of stocks. They own thousands of stakes in various companies. And one thing we've been speaking to the regulator about is to literally plug that gap in revenue, they can simply just sell down some of their state-owned stakes, like 5%, 3% of the stakes. And they were kind of worried that it would just, you know, the market would just fall. So we suggested using exchangeable convertible bonds to do that. So when the stock goes up, then effectively the investor of the bond just converts into the shares of the company, and there's no pressure on the market. So they have taken that. They've actually now introduced that, and some government shares are being sold down that way. And then they're quite big. It's maybe 20 billion RMB, 25 billion RMB each deal. So they're pretty decent sized deals. But yeah, I mean, there's a long way to go. I mean, there's so many things China can do. And really, I think that's where we are now. I think the future, as I say, it's an inflection point. The future is really exciting. You're going to have derivatives, you're going to have options, warrants, you're going to have lots of different ways of actually hedging and mitigating.
I want to circle back to a comment that you made about, partly about risk and about access to onshore sort of debt instruments. And one thing that strikes me as still quite remarkable is that the participation of foreign institutional investors in the onshore debt market is still very, very, very small. At least on the corporate debt, it's still in the single digits, if I'm not mistaken, if not low double digits. Why do you think that is, even to this very day?
I'd say especially so given the low historical default rates and also the fact that if I was in Europe or the US investing in a government bond, what's your upside? The interest rates are only going to rise, especially with current inflation. China, actually, it looks like they're probably going to lower interest rates. So holding Chinese bonds actually seems to be a relatively sensible thing to do. I think it's partly that international investors have to accept significantly higher return for taking the risk of investing into China. It's another country. It involves a lot of extra work to make directors feel comfortable with this sort of thing. I really do think as long as you are aligning your interests with that of the regulators, the authorities over there, and not just going crazy and leveraging up and doing crazy things, then I think you're very well protected. Again, I mean, you look at the recent drawdowns, you've had a lot of the Chinese stocks that have fallen. They've all been US ADRs or Hong Kong listed, not domestically in China. The thing is that the regulator and the authorities really want to protect retail investors. So wherever retail investors are involved, you're pretty safe. You can stimulate the economy. There's lots of methods that China still has to get them out of any particular problem. In addition, actually, a lot of the inflation problems that we're seeing globally are not hitting China so badly. I mean, I saw today consumer price index inflation was worse than expected. It was 1.5% instead of 1.4%. I mean, compare that to the US where it's 9% or Europe where it's even higher in part. So, I mean, and that's because actually China bought a lot of the raw materials, the grains, the rice. They've got a year or two supply of those quantities already. So they're not being hit with quite the same level of inflation at the moment.
On that note, Mark, one of the biggest topics even on, you know, the CNBC and on Bloomberg is about what are the countervailing forces between U.S. More hawkish approach, obviously needing to tackle inflation, both domestically and whatever else that they've exported. And then you also have China, who's on the other side, who went through the last 2 years of deleveraging, very, very stringent quantitative, actually tightening quantitative policy. And now with a lot, as you mentioned, a lot of ammunition to fight it moving forward. Now, my question is, are there countervailing forces there? And would it put the Fed in a more challenging situation since you have the second largest economy driving liquidity back into the market while the others trying to tighten it up? Or is the domestic market so insulated from the rest of the world that, you know what, it's a nothing burger?
So I think that China will try and look after its people and itself. So if it does stimulate the economy, it's going to do so very selectively, and it's going to do so to enable the growth of the real economy. I mean, you hit on something quite important. You've had, at the same time, there was a trillion or two of stimulus checks being issued around the world, you had tightening of monetary policy in China. So effectively, equities are now trading, the Shanghai Comp's trading at 10 times earnings, future earnings. It's certainly not expensive, but that's because it hasn't had trillions of dollars of people stuck at home looking to trade and trade the market because they've got nothing else to do. So,
Mark, I mean, 10 times earnings? I haven't heard numbers like that since the late 90s.
Yeah, that's the forward earnings. I mean, it's, you know, you compare that with boom markets such as 2015, it was at 40 times earnings. So
yeah, incredible.
China's kind of dangerous because a lot of the investors are retail. It's like a roller coaster. Sometimes it's up 200%, sometimes it's down 60, 70%. So when you see things like, oh my God, Wall Street's crashed, it's down 4%, you kind of think.
Are you concerned about secondary sanctions though, as this war with Russia starts to pan out? China, by association, seems to be thrown into the same bucket. Some of the managers are worried about, okay, you know, we've been blindsided before. Could secondary sanctions for those in aiding and abetting?
A little bit. I mean, I think there will be more sanctions on Chinese companies as a result of the war on Russia. However, it will be very selective, very few. So I think it's just about aligning your interests with what China's trying to do is it's trying to make sure that, you know, you haven't got a massive disparity in social wealth. They're trying to keep everything. They're probably the most capitalist society I think I've ever met. I mean, I've worked in the US, I've worked in London, and compared to that, the Chinese businesses are incredibly cutthroat, incredibly capitalist. But at the same time, you know, I mean, I think the government doesn't want to see a massive wealth disparity, which is why it's effectively limiting some of the scope of the big internet companies and just trying to control things a bit.
Yeah, I think you alluded to an interesting point is that when we look at, and this is something that we try to explain to our investors as well, which is understanding China policy is not, it's not that much, it feels a lot like reading tea leaves because the articulation and the vernacular sometimes appears to be ambiguous. But actually, if you look at thematically their approach to blanket policies, it's actually quite obvious, especially when you look back now on, you know, some of the circulars that were issued 18 months ago, from deleveraging to increasing greater social good. There shouldn't be too much surprise that there was a crackdown on several key industries which were the antithesis of that. So for investors whom we're constantly defending the thesis to all the time, how do you convince them when you look at situations like over the summer when there was a crackdown on education, for example, which quite frankly was surprising to a lot of people, when there was a crackdown on technology and finance? That came as a bit of a surprise as well, because in other countries, technology or tech companies are moving into the financial space. What do you have to say to investors who are trying to also fight for our thesis on their investment committees to push the mandate through?
You look at a lot of the stocks, they have actually, like you mentioned, the technology, the education, they actually looked very attractive. I think for us, it's about trying to find asymmetric return profiles. So being involved in something that, guess what, we get stocks wrong, but if you get it wrong, you lose 10-15%. You get it right, you make 40-50%. It's trying to find that skewed asymmetry to the returns, because guess what, you're not going to get everything right. And just make sure you're diversified. Overall, though, I mean, you are very well compensated for your risk in China. I mean, it's, and the key thing is, a lot of these, if you look at the other markets, say the US or Europe, everything tends to be quite correlated. People are not all in the same names. It's very secular. China is a really nice diversifier for people. It is completely uncorrelated because there's almost no foreign capital, or not to a great extent. It kind of doesn't behave, as you said, on a monetary policy basis. It's not being correlated at all with
Western markets. It's not correlated. And what I find frustrating is sometimes when I speak with even very well-weathered investors, one point that I always take on contest is the home-based bias, which is, well, it's not home-based bias, but they will reflect on the returns of the S&P versus, say, China over the last 3 to 5 years. And they will remark that, you know what, why do I need to come out to emerging markets? Why do I have to come to China if, you know, the S&P continually generates, you know, fantastic returns for me? And I'm almost aghast at statements like that from, and I'm not going to name names, but from very, very seasoned investors, and needing to hold back that, needing to define to them what the importance of non-correlated returns are, and whether they are actually being responsible in pursuing, continually pursuing and creating this flywheel of returns coming from the US markets.
And yeah, I mean, a lot of times what happens is people like the idea, it gets up to the senior investment guy, and they just have some inherent concerns about China. And actually, some of them are very valid concerns, but you just, yeah, the worst thing is if all this work gets put in, and then the CIO has some questions, and it kind of just stops the process. I mean, we're quite happy to answer questions and allay concerns. And actually, guess what? Sometimes actually the best advice we've been given is from potential investors. They've said, well, why don't you do this? What about doing that? Can you, would it be possible to set this up? Okay, we looked into it, and it's actually worked out really well for us and for our existing investors. So we're quite happy to go through the process. Then actually, you know, if you just think selfishly on behalf of China, it's been growing fantastically. It wants to keep growing. It's a growth area. It's growing, you know, not as fast as it was, but it's still the world's highest growth economy as a decent size. And it needs capital. And, you know, so enabling those companies to be able to continue to get capital to build the economy and to grow businesses is essentially what the government wants. And that's what capital markets are really for. There's been a kind of, I'd argue almost the US has become a little bit decoupled from the real economy. I mean, you know, some stocks trading over a trillion dollars, and effectively, and some of them are good companies, and some who knows. But I mean, at least with respect to China, it's been relatively subdued. That's why it's trading on 10 times earnings.
So if you're talking about 10 times earnings, which we're seeing now, not just in Hong Kong, but in Shanghai as well, a lot of our managers are very, very excited about the year coming up, especially if they're starting a new strategy. Very, very excited, because heroes are made in years like 2009, 2016, just after the last crash in China. And here we are today again, at this new reset for the China market ahead of the next cycle. Tell me what you're thinking. Is this, are you guys just as excited, or are you thinking there's still a little bit more pain to go?
I think if you're investing in China, you can't have a 1 week, a 1 day, a 1 month investment horizon. You've got to look at it as a multi-year investment. I really am extremely excited about the opportunities, not just from the equity markets, but also again from the growth of the capital markets. It's going to overtake the US at some point in certain areas in terms of the size of the capital markets, the opportunities. I mean, you don't have 1,000 hedge funds crawling all over these things. So there is really good measurable alpha in a lot of these securities. They're deep and they're liquid. I mean, the one thing that China has done really, really well, take the bond market. It's exchange traded. A lot of it is exchange traded. You can see the bid, the offer, the volume. You can see who holds the bonds. You try doing that in a Japanese bond, a government bond, you've got no idea who owns these. The brokers do. So when you want to come sell them, the bid is a point lower or much lower. So but nobody else does. So because the capital markets came after most other Western economies, they've tried to, like, for example, the stock loan exchange. We went to see the CSFP, I think it's called. They were going to be the world's, and they are the world's first centralized stock loan exchange. So effectively, people deposit securities there and they manage who has access to the share. And that's a great idea. I mean, that's what many authorities and many regulators wanted to track in 2008 and couldn't do. So I think you've got a cheap equity market, you've got a bond market that is probably going to go up and actually already has high yields compared to most other bond markets. Why? I mean, again, it's about having trillions of dollars. I mean, you had managers going into investment grade and then spreads went down. Then you had high yield. Then it was covenant light securities. And then you go into loans just to try and keep your return. You're taking more and more risk on your return. Whereas in China, actually, the returns are still pretty decent without actually having to take on a lot of credit risk, in my opinion. You know, you've got a few things. You've got the fact that most of the world's indices, China's under-owned by everyone. You have MSCI, you have FTSE, you have bond indices increasing their China allocation. And they've said how much it's going to increase over the next 5-10 years. So even just passively, more and more money is going to come into China. It almost has to if they're going to follow any indices. So that's positive. And then you've got the growth in the capital markets, which is something you can't. I've been disappointed, you know, 2003, as I said, like you, we've been invested a long time and we've seen many disappointments from effectively capital market developments being delayed again, again, again. And in one sense, that's quite good because it keeps other people away and it keeps a high degree of alpha in the instruments. But on the other hand, we'd like to see it happen sooner and things open up. And
just for the listeners, the one that Mark and I were a little bit challenged about was the latest QFII release. It's always been a mechanism to allow offshore capital to access onshore capital markets directly, and the new rules for QFII would allow not just derivatives but also the commodities, access to the commodities market, which was very, very exciting. And the regulators had announced that the commodities markets, including the four exchanges and the 77 actual commodities markets themselves, would be accessible 2 years ago, I think it was, right, Mark? I think it was September 2020. Yeah, they announced it, and a whole year went by and nothing happened. Okay, November 2021, they announce again that QFII will allow trading and investments by offshore qualified financial investors offshore coming onshore from November 2021. Still no details on the rules. And a big part of that was because onshore exchanges needed to submit trading rules up to the regulators in order to be approved, so that there could be a consistent treatment of capital between all modes of QFII. And so to this very day, still no word from the regulators. So how do you temper the appetite for investors whom we've spent some time, you know, getting them excited, who are now still in the waiting line and, you know, probably getting bored of the thesis altogether?
So as we were talking, I just pulled up PetroChina. So it's one of the world's largest refineries or oil producers in China, and we don't own any of this. But years ago, we looked at the difference between It's listed in Hong Kong and listed in China. The market's open at the same time. You can buy and sell them. PetroChina in Hong Kong trades at 41% discount as of today to the one in China. It's crazy. It's a $250 billion company trading at a half the value in one market to the other market. As I say, we're not involved in any of these, but I mean, these sort of inefficiencies should actually be quite embarrassing. And actually, we've spoken to the regulator about them, and they've said, look, we are embarrassed by the fact that there's this sort of inefficiency. However, it's quite complicated. You have to, there's lots of different, between the Hong Kong exchange and the Chinese exchange, there's different trading hours, there's different trading amounts, there's different legal obligations, foreign ownerships. There's a whole host of problems that come from these things. So,
do you think they'd move a bit quicker if it was a discount to offshore and the other way around?
I think they probably would, actually. I mean, they kind of consider, I mean, you look at Hong Kong, it's a great place to live, but it trades a tenth of the volume of Shanghai or Shenzhen. It's kind of almost like a provincial market to a lot of them. But again, in terms of dollar flows, Hong Kong is really important to China. China gets a lot of its dollar supply from Hong Kong. So Hong Kong has a financial place in China's future. But we're speaking to the regulator about this probably 2009, 2010. And again, it's still existing. So they do move slowly. But when they do move, they put their foot on the pedal very quickly. I mean, you see from QFII, I mean, you look at the size of the QFII market now, it's expanded really significantly. When we got it, it took years of documents, of process, Now you can do it actually fairly quickly. So it's actually quite easy. So they're really trying to oil the wheels for capital to flow. That's something, I think there's a quote from Xi Jinping or one of the leaders saying, it's important to keep the arteries of capital flowing, but not to leverage up the economy so much. Actually, that sums up China in a nutshell. They don't want to see financial markets get ahead of themselves. They don't want another 1985 in Japan where, the Emperor's Palace costs more than California. But at the same time, they do need to, and they do want to actually open up their capital markets. And they are slowly doing so. Not as fast as we would like, but I think you wait 5 years' time. The change does seem to be actually accelerating because I think they've just become more and more comfortable that, the investments they're receiving are aligned in their interests. I mean, originally when I spoke to the regulators, we were talking about warrants, introducing warrants. And warrants used to be a really big thing in Japan. But, there was the biggest options market in the world. And we're talking to them about it. And they as soon as they heard hedge funds or shorting, they just didn't want to even talk about it. Now they've got a centralized stock loan exchange. It's still very expensive and very difficult to actually access, but they are moving and they are feeling more comfortable with Western capitalism as a means of actually supplying companies. But they're doing it on their own terms, like credit risk mitigation. They had that actually before 2008. Then when 2008 happened, they thought, actually, it caused all these problems. It didn't necessarily work as an effective hedging tool. And so they put a stop to it. And they'll try other things. But they, again, that's two steps forward, one step back. I think there's a Chinese phrase where you cross the river by feeling the stone. So you move slowly, you tiptoe across the river. And if you take your time, you'll get across and you'll be safe. If you just charge in, it's a problem.
It is a long game. And a lot of investors who are expecting knee-jerk reactions to, foreign policy or to even the war, etc., I don't think they realize that, China takes a very, very, very long, multi-decade policy approach to how they're going to react to, shifts in the market. So, there's still plenty of time for everyone. Let's talk a little bit about Hong Kong. And you've been in Hong Kong for a very long time. And like, I'm Canadian by birth, having had the privilege of being both in a, capitalistic and democratic society, now coming back to Hong Kong, been in Hong Kong for well over 20 years, I find that, Hong Kong has taken a massive beating in the last three years. I find myself defending Hong Kong and by default, in a way, China to an extent to a lot of our investors overseas, as well as friends overseas who are very, very confused by the narrative that's being drawn out in fake news, etc. But, you know, you say it enough, it sticks to the wall. And the narrative becomes so strong that even the U.S., you don't have to be Democrat or Republican to be anti-China, because to be anything but anti-China would be anti-American. And so here we are today, where if you're to vote on sanctions against Hong Kong or China, etc., you get nearly a unanimous vote at the Senate. What's your view? Where do we go from here?
It was kind of always in a difficult position. When you get diverging views, Hong Kong is a gateway. It's East meets West. It's flow of, and that always made it, in my opinion, one of the most exciting cities in the world to be in, because where you get a confluence, all the great intellectual centers have generally been around ports. Whether you're happy, you know, it's based on lots of things. But from a financial perspective, Hong Kong has seen a lot of people leave. But actually, when the COVID situation settles down, and hopefully it will fairly soon, when this all settles down, people will come back to Hong Kong. I'm pretty confident that Hong Kong will see very big growth, particularly in the financial sector, simply because actually what you're going to see, and you're already seeing, you're seeing lots more IPOs in Hong Kong, you're seeing lots more Chinese companies list in Hong Kong, and you're seeing some of the Chinese companies listed in the US, again, move back to Hong Kong. So you're seeing that, you're seeing more capital markets development, and it's going to open up much more with China.
Mark, I'd had a lot of people actually ask me to relay the same question, which has to do with crypto and digital assets. Last year, as you know, China banned Bitcoin mining and turned their backs on this entire sort of asset class, of which, you know, both of us are sort of slightly entering into right now. And because of Hong Kong laws, it's very, very difficult to take a full dive into. What's your view of, you know, did China make a mistake in turning its back on digital assets, or did it make the right move in banning it altogether? Because here I am, and here we are in Hong Kong, seeing both sides. We see, yes, more stable sort of financial controls, but we also see the U.S. taking a very positive and aggressive approach at regulating the asset class, very much at the expense of, some would argue, Hong Kong and China's future development.
Yeah, I mean, I this is a broader question, because, I mean, the one thing about cryptocurrencies is that governments have no control, and China always wants to make sure it has control. That's something that's embedded in the psyche of the leadership. So they are going to develop cryptocurrency, but it will be a government cryptocurrency, not an independent one. Already, if you go into China, you try and pay cash with anyone, and they look at you as though you're from a dark age. It's like, what? I don't want to touch cash. It's something that's considered so weird. Most taxi drivers will not accept cash anymore. They've moved to electronic payment, and I think they're going to move to a full government cryptocurrency. And that has positives and negatives. I mean, the positives are obvious. The negatives are that every single transaction can be monitored and tracked, which is why I think libertarian societies like the US don't particularly want to go down that route, or don't want to have a government cryptocurrency. They want it to be a free market. It's difficult to gamble in Hong Kong, as you know, but so what a lot of people were doing was using cryptocurrencies to go on online casinos, because that completely circumvented all the gambling rules in Hong Kong. So, like anything, it's almost like whack-a-mole. When there's a regulation or restriction, that hole's closed up, another one pops up. So my prediction will be Bitcoin will, I know it's gained a lot of status and it's almost like an index, but eventually that will be phased out, as you say, for proof of stake a lot more. I think Hong Kong could actually be an interesting place to actually develop and work with NFTs and stuff like that.
Mark, have you ever had your investors ask if you could take the skill set that you've learned over the last 20 years, which you've done very well to extract and generate alpha out of China and extract, you know, find inefficiencies in the market to bring returns back to your investors and shareholders, that you could take the same skill set and apply it to other emerging markets? And I ask this because we're in this interesting phase right now where India is positioning itself as China 2.0. And then you have ASEAN, which is also benefiting from massive outflows of capital from China to, you know, Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore. And what do you say to those investors? And is this something that you would consider?
We do look, yeah. We do look all the time. We're always monitoring different markets because, again, you can take a lot of those skill sets. The skill sets were applicable to Japan, and now they've been moved to China. And the difference is the scale at which China is actually on. It's orders of magnitude more than, you know. So if your capacity is $5 billion, it may be $50 million if you go to another smaller effort. And also, I mean, again, it's like everything is exchanged, or a lot of it is exchange traded. They've learned from the mistakes of many other markets, and they've kind of, it's almost like in their infrastructure in general, they've built new roads, new rails, everything's kind of, and obviously things will decay over time and require a lot of repairs, but at the moment it's a fully functioning working system with lots of liquidity and decent capacity. So I don't think anything else in the near term will touch it, even though there might be a lot of opportunities. I mean, I've traded markets in the Philippines, Thailand, all over the place. And, you know, it's just not the same. So, I mean, yeah, I think even Japan now, the volume in Japan is a fraction of what it is in China. China is almost an order of magnitude higher than Japan in terms of trading volume and number of companies. So it would take a lot for us to look at other markets in the short term. And the long term, I think you will see a transition. Vietnam would be interesting. Korea actually would be quite interesting because Korea has lots and lots of chaebol structures. So you'd have a lot of unwinding of those corporate structures. Will create a lot of opportunity, but just not at the moment.
If you were to speak to yourself 20 years ago when you started on this journey as principal, what would you tell him today that you did not know before?
I think never be afraid to ask questions. I came in from academia. Luckily, I was a high-energy nuclear physicist. And all the time you're asking questions, and people are kind of happy to give you answers. People really want to see you learn. When I came into finance, people were like, oh, you're an idiot. Oh, no, stupid question. And I kept thinking, there's no such thing as a stupid question, which of course there is. They're like, what's the sound of green is a stupid question. But I kept at it. And luckily, when I met all sorts of people. I met Myron Scholes. I met a lot of interesting guys. And it was just really, really interesting to learn about different areas of the market. And it still is. To me, it's not just about, okay, we made money on this, we lost money on that. It's really about trying to understand how the instruments are priced, why they're offered at such levels, why do the companies do that, really actually try and understand the motivations from all the different parties. And so just keep asking questions. No matter what people say, just keep on asking questions, because it doesn't matter. You'll be considered stupid for a while, but eventually you'll know more than the people that are calling you stupid.
Wise words for anyone looking at investing into a new market, asset class, emerging or otherwise. Mark, it's been a tremendous thrill to be speaking with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alvin. You've asked some really great questions. I appreciate it.
As we've heard today, China is the second largest economy in the world, the second largest equity market in the world, and one of the largest bond markets in the world. To find out more about SBAI's work on the topic of China, please visit our website at sbai.org. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.